Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
The sun shone all through my leave-insert summer. I'm not imagining that, or holding it in some eternal blossom of memory. It was the summer of 1976, with record-high temperatures, an oasis of time between the end of secondary school and whatever came after my exam results arrived. We basked in the waiting, sunbathed on our garage roof, swam in Rogers Burn. Rathmullen Beach called often that summer, and we thumbed there from Letterkenny and home again afterwards. There was always someone who knew us to stop and give us a lift along the way. Once, a friend and myself decided to cycle to Rathmullen. But by the time we had cycled the 8 miles to a mountain, we decided it was too hot to try and cycle another 7 miles. So we went into the Garda barracks and asked them if we could leave our bicycles there. The guards agreed, so we left them in the entrance corridor and thumbed the rest of the way to Rathmullen and then home again. My dad helped us collect the bikes in his car the next day. It was like that all the Leaving Cert summer, a start-stop type of journey. Are we there yet? Feeling confident one day and anxious the next. We loved the sunshine, but still, the wonder of what was ahead hung over us like a storm cloud. What's for you won't go by you, people said. But I had no idea what really was for me. When I had been in Leaving Cert classes, I'd sit looking out our classroom window, and way out in the distance, I could see a large tree in a vacant field with a canopy of leaves. I always wished I could be there, just sitting on the grass under the tree as a place of sanctuary. But I never knew exactly where that tree was or where to find sanctuary. I had applied for a few different courses, kept changing my mind as to what I wanted to do, who I wanted to be in the future. Eventually it came down to a choice of two places, Calbrough Street in Dublin or Letterkenny Regional College. I wanted to get away from Donegal, as so many others were doing at the time, but Mum had passed away 4 years beforehand. I was the eldest daughter. I worried about leaving my family. There was a strong pull to go away, but a guilt about leaving, and the final decision would all come down to my exam results. Even the popular music of the time seemed to pull us in all directions. Gallagher and Lyle sang I Want to Stay With You. T-Rex was on Top of the Pops with I Love to Boogie. And the Wurzels, singing Combine Harvester, made it to number one in the charts. Thin Lizzy sang The Boys Are Back in Town. But friends were getting ready to leave town. The boarders from the Loretto Convent and the college had all already gone home. And the boys who played Gaelic football went to America and were set up in jobs if they played football there. Are we there yet? There was a clear feeling of childhood finally being left behind. I worked for my aunt and her B&B that summer. I thought I wanted to do hotel management or supervision. On Sunday mornings, if guests hadn't arrived down for breakfast by a certain time, my aunt would make me go upstairs, knock on the guest's bedroom door and say, breakfast will be over soon. The cook is going to mass. I dreaded that job. And always the waiting for the results. My relatives would say, how do you think you got on? I thought I might just manage to get 4 honours if I could get an honour in Spanish. I knew I would fail Latin. Probably the only reason I had even studied Latin was because we had to leave the convent and go up to the college for Latin classes there. That definitely was a novelty and a distraction. But the results were all that mattered that summer. My grandmother in West Cork was keen that I'd do well. Her neighbour's children were studying to be engineers and doctors. I knew there was no competition. My results weren't going to give my granny any bragging rights. the summer of 76. The sunshine brought solace. And come August, Kiki Dee and Elton John sang Don't Go Breaking My Heart. My results came. 3 honours. Enough to go to Calbrew Street and stay in a hostel in Mountjoy Square. Looking back, it wasn't the right career choice for me in the long term. But that didn't matter. It was a safe place I'd been looking for. A sanctuary that led me into the next stage of my life.
One summer in the 1990s, I had a waitressing job in a small town in Italy. I used to ring home reversing the charges, which meant talking to a long-distance telephone operator in Ireland. Even before I got to talk to my family, I'd be transported home in spirit by this woman's quintessentially Irish appetite for a chat. Ah, Emma, is it? Weren't we only talking last week? We were. Will your parents be home, do you think? I'd say so, that's why I'm calling. You're in Italy, aren't you? My niece is thinking of doing her wedding there. And are you eating well? You must be. And aren't you the lucky cow to be having a nice summer in Italy? The phone would go silent for a minute before she'd come back. I have your dad ready for you. Sounds like a very nice man. You want me to put him on to you, I suppose. And with great reluctance, she'd leave us to our conversation. Later that same summer, I had another encounter with a chatty, disembodied voice when my boyfriend and I visited a short-lived heritage centre in Tremor called Celtworld. It was hot the day that we went, and there were very few other visitors as we walked along the guided path through dark exhibition spaces, being nudged here to watch videos, there to listen to voices and moving animatronic bodies. Occasionally, we'd be passed by an actor dressed in a cloak and brooch, wandering the straw-strewn floor, muttering that they were looking for their sword or their child. The end of the route led into a massive room which had all sorts of things to explore, the most notable being a collection of severed heads dangling from the ceiling. The message had been hammered home to us by now that the Celts loved to display the heads of their slain enemies to warn off other foes. As I waited for my boyfriend to catch up from the previous fascinating exhibit, I wandered around the space. And then I heard a voice. It said, "Whoa, woe is me." I stayed still and it spoke again. "I'm over here, my life long seeped from my body, but here to bear witness." I looked up above me and saw a single head with long greasy hair swinging around its face. Right, I responded, wondering how I was supposed to interact with this exhibit. "What happened to you?" The head's mouth moved to speak. "I was caught in an ambush at the edge of the village. We were defending our families from the Vikings, those murderous Danes. But a group from a rival village came rampaging from up the river, no doubt looking to take our prime location." The head told me its tale, going through the full script. I listened politely until the speech seemed over. "Sorry to hear all that," I said, and started to move around the room. A minute or two later, the voice spoke again. "So, are you from Dublin?" "I am, yeah." I paused. "And you?" Thinking this might lead to a story of how this ancient warrior had moved around the country. "I used to live there, yeah, but I'm down here for the summer now." "Right. I'm from out Santry way. Where are you yourself?" Near Dean's Grange, Southside. "Oh, my aunt lives around there. Clonkeen, I think it is. Do you know the Tumulties?" I don't think so. My parents might know them." "Yeah, she works at the shop there in Dean's Grange. Super Quinn, is it?" No, it's a Super Value." "Right, yeah, it's nice around there. And are you just down in Tremor for like a couple of days?" "We are, yeah, first time." "Ah, it's nice, all right. Bit quiet in the evenings, though. You heading out tonight?" My boyfriend arrived into the room. The head went quiet, but not for long. Soon enough, it's chatting with the boyfriend about his part of Dublin and suggestions for good pubs in Tramore. Before I could keep us there all day in the empty room, we said goodbye to the plastic head with its eyes suspended in a fierce but scared stare. We left the centre and blinked in the bright sunshine, feeling a little dazed, but also warmed by that thing Irish people just have to do, of finding something in common, whether it's across the miles or even across the millennia, on a boring summer's day.
Conversation, a little more action, please. All this aggravation ain't satisfaction in me. A little more bite, a little less spark, a little less fight, a little more spark. Close your mouth and open up your heart.
I discovered the Fox Den by accident early one morning when I spotted the cub eyeing me quizzically from a safe distance behind a clutch of ferns. I've seen many foxes in the woods over the years, usually in the early morning when a flash of orange streaks across my peripheral vision. I watched as the cub ducked through the undergrowth beneath a big alder tree and I followed him. The ground was freshly dug, two holes on either side of the heaped up earth. I made myself as quiet and as small as I could, hiding behind the tall grass. Timidly, the cub poked his head out of the den and I watched, not daring to breathe. He was followed by a sibling and then another. Three cubs. Too young to be afraid, they watched me from a safe distance, their bolt hole nearby should I move. That was weeks ago when the bluebells were in the first rush of purple, before the ferns unfurled their heads and grew taller than me. Over the course of this summer, I have learned a patience I didn't know I possessed. I've learned how to sit still, the fox cubs, my teachers. I have spent many evenings crouched under the big alder, waiting for them to come out at night. They're not dogs, and they won't be summoned or come on my command. They are creatures of freedom that have shown me not to expect anything from their wildness except what they choose to give. I discovered that the best time to see them is when the light is fading, when they can be their most furtive selves. As the blackbirds gave a final rousing call before settling down for the night, the cubs would come out. They made shapes in the dying light, a dance of sorts with siblings. Their mother had gone out to hunt. I saw her in the clearing through the trees, and I knew she had seen me too. I think she knew that I was bringing little morsels or berries for her babies. These months were a time of innocence for the cubs, a time before they had to rely on their own cunning, although they always had some of it. Cubhood would be short, and as I sat under the alder, looking up into its branches, I couldn't help but think how my children climbed this very tree when they were small boys, proclaiming it a great lookout spot right over Loch Foyle. Not that long ago, they came here to play and to shoot arrows, their territory widening as they explored new ground. The fox mother and I have that in common. Her babies were also busy making new tracks through the ferns every day, expanding their world. Watching, waiting in the gloaming, my senses become sharper. My ears are finely tuned to rustles in the undergrowth. A dried leaf falling causes a tumult. A breeze becomes a hurricane. A pigeon flapping in the trees makes a noise like the clap of thunder. Watching demands a deep, settled hush. I get used to sitting and not moving. Cramp sets into my legs. As night falls, I get cold sometimes. But then, just as I think I may as well head on home, a voice inside urges me to wait a minute longer, that they will come. It's often as I'm about to leave that a small, foxy body will dart out, his long, fat tail disappearing behind a tree. The woods and this space under the alder become a portal to another world, a world of enchantment. My mind wanders to stories of wildlife photographers who often spend days in cramped positions to get footage of an elusive animal. I think what a privilege it is to sit for a while as the woods darken and the bats come out and the owls swoop silently by. I disappear here too, and yes, it's a form of escapism that no Netflix show or miniseries can replicate. My whole body is focused on seeing these creatures. I am an arrow, all a quiver. As the weeks pass, the woods change shape. They grow and green. The dry weather spell leaves the undergrowth brittle, and even the stealthiest paws make noise. As I watch, I also consider the fact that I too am being watched, or perhaps tolerated. As they grow, the cubs become more wary of me, until they finally become the sleek creatures of stealth they were always meant to be. I see them less and less. The intimate world of the den and around it is too small for them then. On so many nights, I walk back to my house, feeling more alive in the knowledge that these wild creatures live just a heartbeat away. Sitting at the edge of their world has been a gift of summer. I will hold it long into the winter nights.
Fox in the snow. Where do you go to find something you could eat? 'Cause the word out on the street is you are starving. Don't let yourself go hungry now. Don't let yourself go
cold. I sat on my own in a stylish drawing room in central Dublin, waiting for one of the great names of the day in Irish theatre to make his appearance. I was a student at Queen's University Belfast and a keen university actor. One summer, in the late 1950s, I was invited by Dublin University players to join their company for the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. We would rehearse at the Players' Theatre in Trinity College. Apart from a late-night review, the main project was W.B. Yeats's Cuchulainn cycle of one-act plays featuring the legendary hero. The last of them, The Death of Cuchulainn, has an unusual prologue not directly linked to the play's content. An ageing speaker, presumably Yeats himself, complains that he is out of fashion and ridicules artistic trends he can't stand, including French Impressionism. Among various roles that I was chosen to play, this one was the trickiest. It was agreed that I should try to sound like Yeats as an old man. So I should talk to someone who had known him. "What about Micheál MacLiarmore?" said the producer. "He knew him." "But would he be willing to see me?" I said. "Yes, I think he would. He likes the work we do here. We'll fix it." So there I was a few days later in Micheál's house in Harcourt Terrace. A servant had escorted me to the drawing room, gestured towards a sofa, and asked me to wait. It was an anxious wait. The man I had come to visit had dedicated his life as actor, playwright, set designer, and producer to the cause of Irish theatre, and was soon to win further acclaim for his one-man show about Oscar Wilde. But in the words of one biographer, "The greatest of all the distinguished parts he played was not that of Hamlet, of Robert Emmet, of Iago, or even Oscar Wilde, but the creation known as Micheál MacLiarmore." Suddenly, he was in the room. He swept past me without a word or sideways glance, crossed to one of the windows, and gazed out into the afternoon sun. His face was discreetly rouged, and his eyes mascaraed. He wore a loose purple shirt over black slacks and slippers.
"Yeats," he said, followed by a long pause, "was a hawk."
Then he turned to greet me with a smile. Michal's coaching method was straightforward. It was not what I had expected. First, he himself declaimed the prologue, pacing up and down, speaking the lines with bravado, savouring the invective.
I spit upon the dancers painted by Degas. I spit upon their short bodices, their stiff stays, their toes whereon they spin like peg-tops.
We then changed places. He sat on the sofa, while I did the pacing and declaiming.
That's good, dear boy, you're getting there.
He then got to his feet and gave another performance, followed by another one from me, and so on, this way and that, for nearly half an hour. He then told me he had another appointment to go to, and wished me and my fellows every success in Edinburgh, where he felt sure that I would make a valuable contribution. Apart from those words of encouragement, and others in the previous half hour, there had been little or no discussion of the content of the prologue itself, or of how to play it. It was as though he simply wanted me to absorb his interpretation and make it my own. Sure enough, when I rehearsed the piece next day at Trinity, I got a round of applause. "I've heard recordings by Yeats," said our producer, "and you don't sound remotely like him. But it's an impressive take-off of Micheál MacLearmore. Keep it that way." So that's how I played it a few weeks later at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, hoping that the maestro who had coached me would have reckoned I got it right.
And over the mice in the barley sheaves, yellow the leaves are.
A circus tent appeared in the football field last week, an annual moment of excitement and expectation. Perhaps not the same excitement as 60 years ago, and perhaps only for those of us old enough to remember when circuses and carnivals were the only shows in town. The sight of the blue dome towering over the roadway, the fluttering of the flags above it, the posters in shop windows along the streets of Carlow, all took me back to the circuses that visited my home village in the early 60s. And to one circus in particular, and one late summer night that had already stretched a hand towards autumn. My mother had been reticent to allow me to go, but my sister Dolores put in a good word for me, and as the clock ticked towards 8 p.m, I was given the necessary spondulix and sent on my way. In my naivety, I thought the show would start on time, so I raced along Abbeylands, through Carlow Gate, across the square and down Keenan's Lane. And there was the big top, decked in coloured bulbs, tinny music blaring from a tannoy speaker. I handed over my money at the kiosk and stepped inside the tent. Never had a transformation so impressed me. The grass which we played on year-round had a magic quality. It wasn't green. It was orange and blue and yellow and red in the fading and flickering lights that shone above the circus ring. Wooden seats rose on all sides, lifting my expectations with them, but they were mostly empty. A handful of people sat near the top. A scattering of children sat on the lower rows. I found myself a spot where I could lean back against the seat behind and waited for the show to begin, which eventually it did. The delay for the hoped-for last-minute rush had proved fruitless. And even as a 12-year-old, I could see the disappointment in the ringmaster's face as he strode into the ring and addressed us in a commanding voice. "Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to this evening's spectacular and exciting show. You will see acts of derring-do, acts of extraordinary courage, acts of death-defying agility, and you will meet some of the most terrifying wild animals on Earth. All of this before your very eyes. Welcome to the circus. And with that, the band struck up. Or was it a recording? I couldn't be sure. And anyway, it didn't matter. In came a young woman leading four white horses, which circled and pranced and placed their front hooves on boxes and danced and did whatever the young woman bade them do. They were followed by a juggler and then a clown who ran amok through the crowd, firing his water pistol at the scattered onlookers. And so the evening progressed. The lion tamer and the lions. An elephant that looked bewildered and sad, his movements slow and unnatural even to my childish eyes. The interval arrived. The young woman who had led the white horses was suddenly selling candy floss and minerals. The lion tamer was selling tickets for a raffle. The ringmaster was reminding us that for a mere shilling we could visit the animals when the show was over. Lights dimmed, silence fell. A young woman and man bounded into the ring, did several pirouettes, and climbed the swaying ladders that took them high into the roof space. They swung and swayed and dangled individually from their precarious swing seats. And then began the leaping and catching, the oohs and ahs from those of us below. One final swooping swing, one last clasp of hands on wrists, one mistimed catch that didn't work, and the young woman plummeted to the ground below. A long silence that probably was no more than 2 seconds, but it seemed to last forever. The ringmaster and two or three circus performers surrounded the young woman, and immediately music struck up, a madcap tune that seemed so out of place. And before we knew it, not one but two clowns were tumbling and falling, chasing each other along the seats, almost but never quite colliding, forcing the audience to duck and dive as they emptied water buckets filled with shredded paper over us. So that by the time our attention returned to the ring, it was empty. The good news reached us the next day. The young trapeze artist had escaped with a broken ankle. Over the following 2 evenings of performance, the big top was packed. "You never know," my friend said to me, as he told me he'd bought tickets for both shows. "It might happen again." "It can't," I said. "The girl is still in hospital." For a moment, he was disappointed, but then his eyes brightened. "Yeah, but the lion might bite the lion tamer's head off. Now that'd be worth seeing."
Open for you. Simon and Garfunkel opened for Frank Zappa. Bo Diddley opened for The Clash. Wheatus opened for Bowling for Soup. 60-Foot Dolls opened for Ash. Husker Du opened for Johnny Thunders. John Lee Shannon opened for The Gypsy Kings. Hugh Cornwell opened for The Undertones. Blondie opened for The Kinks. A Flock of Seagulls opened for the Human League. The Human League opened for Susie Sue. Nine Inch Nails opened for Metallica. I might just open for you. If Nine Inch Nails opened for Metallica, I might just open for you. Metallica opened for Anthrax. Jerry Lee Lewis opened for The Doors. Shanana opened for Jimi Hendrix. Charlie XCX opened for Paramore. The Teardrop Explodes opened for Dexy's Midnight Runners. Blue Oyster Cult opened for Uriah Heep. Joe Cocker opened for Tina Turner. Nirvana opened for the Tragically Hip. Simple Minds opened for the Pretenders. The Pretenders opened for U2. Slayer opened for Pantera. It could be, I'll open for you. If Slayer opened for Pantera, it could be, I'll open for you. In that world where there are no second acts, though Thin Lizzy opened for Queen, yea, verily, when Freddie still held court. Meanwhile, back in the Department of Fun Facts, Warren Zevon opened for the Everlys, when he himself could have done with a little support. The Everlys opened for Simon and Garfunkel. Jethro Tull opened for Yes. John Anderson opened for Vangelis. The Go-Go's opened for INXS. Aerosmith opened for Mott the Hoople. The Yardbirds opened for the Troggs. Ween opened for Uncle Tupelo. Lucius opened for the War on Drugs. Joan Jett opened for Billy Idol. Billy Idol opened for The Who. Dashboard Confessional opened for Goo Goo Dolls. I might still open for you. If Dashboard Confessional opened for Goo Goo Dolls, I might still open for you.
On this morning's Sunday Miscellany, we heard The Summer of 76 by Denise Blake, The Head on You by Emma Prunty, Fox Cubs was by Cathy Donaghy, Micheál Mac Liomór by Dennis Toohey, Send in the Clouds, Clowns by John McKenna, and Open for You by Paul Muldoon. The music was Don't Go Breaking My Heart by Elton John and Kiki D, A Little Less Conversation by Elvis Presley, The Fox in the Snow by Belle and Sebastian, The Falling of the Leaves, performed by Eleanor Shanley, and Send in the Clowns, performed by Judy Collins. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back to the programme on the programme website, on the RTE radio app, or on all the usual podcast platforms. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.